I just love seeing you all come in like this.
He's talking about the new refiners joining the Severed Patreon page. Just $5 a month and no cranial drill required. Go to patreon.com/severedpod.
Okay, you're all set.
Severed, the ultimate severance podcast.
Welcome back, Refiner. So glad you've chosen to join me for another edition of Severed, the Ultimate Severance Podcast. I'm your host, Alan S. As we continue to wait for word about the debut of Season 2, I've been delving into those things that inspired Dan Erickson as he was creating Severance. The result has been the Severed Origins series. This edition of Severed Origins is just a bit different. To this point, most of our episodes have dealt with movies that inspired DE. This time out, we're going to take a look at a single 90-minute episode of a streaming TV series. Dan specifically called out the White Christmas episode of the Netflix anthology Black Mirror as being particularly inspiring. All of Black Mirror is weirdly dark and trippy, but this one episode is especially out there. It's such a unique episode, it isn't actually part of a Black Mirror season. White Christmas is listed on Netflix as being the fourth episode in the second season. This isn't exactly accurate. White Christmas exists as an episode all on its own, apart from the rest of the series. It also happens to be the highest rated and most widely watched episode of Black Mirror. If you haven't seen it yet, you really should. Which brings us to the spoiler disclaimer. As usual, Refiners, disgusting and unapologetic spoilers are ahead for White Christmas. If you'd like to see it before you hear it, you can stream all seasons of Black Mirror, including the White Christmas episode, with Netflix. You remember Netflix, right? I would also like to point out that since there are several Easter eggs in this episode pointing to other Black Mirror episodes, there's a good chance I'm going to be spoiling those episodes as well. If you haven't seen any of it and you want to go into Black Mirror cold, tread lightly from here on out. As a fan of Severance, I would guess you're going to love Black Mirror. Don't hesitate to add it to your viewing queue. If you're already a fan of Charlie Brooker and his twisted skewering of technology, then you probably already know a lot of this origin story. The rest of you may be asking, now, what exactly is Black Mirror? Well, short answer, it's a British anthology series along the lines of Twilight Zone. Instead of Rod Serling, Black Mirror is driven by a Brit named Charlie Brooker and his darkly prophetic visions about the evolution of technology. It's speculative fiction set in the near future with sci-fi technology that mirrors but also expands our current real-world technology. Brooker has said, quote, "It's about the way we live now and the way we might be living in 10 minutes if we're clumsy." Charlie Brooker is a British comedian, satirist, and social critic. He was born in Reading, Berkshire in March of 1971. Brooker started his prolific media career in his teens as a cartoonist. His cartooning landed him a spot as a writer and reviewer for PC Zone magazine. From there, he went on to a TV review column and a regular series of unusual columns for The Guardian called Supposing. Brooker developed a reputation for being thought-provoking, shocking, and edgy, whatever he was doing. In more than one instance, cartoons or articles from Brooker have caused a publication to be pulled from store shelves. By 2000, Brooker had made the move to TV, working for the British free-to-air, publicly-owned Channel 4. He was writing for a show called The 11 O'Clock Show. It was a satirical skewering of news items along the lines of what would eventually become The Daily Show on Comedy Central. The blend of satire, social commentary, and current events was fertile territory for Brooker's creativity. Brooker's association with Channel 4 would prove fruitful. It was on Channel 4 where he started his Wipe series of programs with Charlie Brooker's Screen Wipe in 2006. There would also be News Wipe, Games Wipe, and starting in 2010, his end-of-the-year Wipe wrap-up specials. There was also Election Wipe in 2015 and the two-part special Anti-Viral Wipe from May of 2020. Anti-Viral Wipe, as you might have guessed, was devoted to a humorous look at British life during the pandemic. Brooker's science fiction anthology series Black Mirror first aired on Channel 4 in December of 2011. There were a total of 3 episodes that first season, airing on 3 successive Sunday nights. They were dark, but very well received. The main theme of the first ever Black Mirror episode really kind of sums up Brooker's brand of cringe. In the episode titled The National Anthem, we see a man awaken to a blackmail plot. In a very believable turn of events, the fictional Prime Minister of Great Britain is forced to have sex with an actual pig on national television. It's the kind of situation that might get a chuckle as a punchline to a bad joke in a seedy bar. Brooker takes the situation from an uncomfortable chuckle to something truly dark and disturbing as we go through the logistics of making political bestiality actually happen on live TV. I've always described Black Mirror to friends like this. Remember those episodes of The Twilight Zone that stuck with you? Burgess Meredith in a bank vault with broken glasses, the beautiful woman declared hideous by a society of uggos, and of course, the demon on the wing of a jet. You can't forget them. They've taken up residence in your brain. I feel like every episode of Black Mirror is one of those unforgettable, teasy episodes. I think it's why the seasons are so short. Instead of giving us 22 episodes with 3 standouts, Brooker does away with the fluff and only gives us the 3 standouts. Brooker says the black mirror of the series title is a media screen. It's the shiny black screen of a phone, computer, or television before you turn on the power. What happens in the black mirror, according to Brooker, is the true reflection of our lives and society as a whole. Channel 4 commissioned the second season of Black Mirror in February of 2013. It would also consist of 3 episodes. Since each episode was basically a mini movie, the cost per episode was prohibitive. There was no economy of scale or reusing of sets. Everything was created from scratch for each episode. Channel 4 is publicly owned, but it does not receive any public funding. Financing in-house productions came out of an operating budget fed only by advertising. Channel 4 had Black Mirror in the budget as a comedy. Brooker was, after all, a comedian. Black Mirror easily became the most expensive comedy offering on the channel and the least humorous. By the 3rd season, it was obvious Channel 4 would need a co-producer in order to shoulder the expense of these very ambitious stories. Brooker and his production team had traveled to Los Angeles looking for co-production dollars. This is where they made a connection with monster streamer Netflix. Netflix released the first 2 seasons of Black Mirror to the U.S. market starting in December of 2014. Netflix also outbid a number of companies for rights to continue the series with 2 more seasons of 10 episodes each. Brooker and Netflix were both very open to having Channel 4 involved, but Channel 4 got weird about wanting full treatments in advance. Brooker ultimately went with Netflix for continued development. The 3rd and 4th seasons wound up being 6 episodes each. The seasons were released with fewer episodes than planned because the producers would run out of both time and money. Black Mirror was all about being edgy and experimental. They produced and delivered, with technical help from Netflix, the incredible standalone interactive film called Bandersnatch. Netflix then footed the bill for a 5th season of 3 episodes and a 6th season of 5 episodes. A 7th season was announced by Netflix in November of 2023. It's scheduled to consist of 6 episodes, but as usual, we won't know how many actually get delivered until Charlie says they're done. Currently, after 6 seasons, 27 episodes of the series have been produced. This one, White Christmas, is possibly the oddest of the 27. It was released on December 16th of 2014 as a special under the Black Mirror header. It was not tied to any one season. It aired on Channel 4 about 20 months after the final episode of the second season and 22 months before season 3 would debut on Netflix. As mentioned, Netflix lists it as the last episode of the second season. White Christmas easily became the highest-rated episode of the series ever aired. It might have been due to pent-up viewer demand. Black Mirror fans hadn't seen anything new from Brooker in quite a while. The show was on hold at the time White Christmas was produced. Channel 4 had rejected Brooker's Season 3 script ideas as not very Black Mirror. Brooker was looking for a way to continue the anthology series. He was told by his producer, Annabelle Jones, that Channel 4 had a budget for an hour-long Christmas special. Brooker pushed for 90 minutes, which he was given. He then included three different storylines in this one dark special. White Christmas would be the final Black Mirror episode produced by Channel 4. This episode was directed by Carl Tibbetts. Carl is a director who also has a single writer and a single editor credit on IMDb. There is no personal information on Carl's profile, but as a director, we discover Carl called the shots on two Black Mirror episodes. They were some of his earliest work as a director. In addition to White Christmas, Carl also directed the much-loved second season episode, White Bear. Interesting that Carl's only Black Mirror episodes are two with the word white in the title. Carl does also like to play with skewed perceptions. Since it's an anthology, each episode of Black Mirror is standalone. There are no carried-over storylines or characters, but these stories do seem to exist in a shared universe. We will see Easter eggs throughout White Christmas that reference events from other Black Mirror episodes. These little details have no impact on the story, and it's not necessary that you understand the references. They are included as a bonus by Brooker for hardcore Black Mirror fans. He really thought White Christmas was going to be the last episode ever of the anthology, so he packed in the callbacks. There are a number of folks who have caught and cataloged these glancing and subtle references to other episodes. I'll make sure to point them out when we get there. White Christmas is unique in another respect. It's the first episode of the show to feature an American lead. Jon Hamm of Mad Men fame had been introduced to the series by his friend Bill Hader back when it could be seen on DirecTV. Hamm was so hooked as a fan, he wanted to be a part of this groundbreaking series. In mid-2014, while doing a press tour in the UK, Hamm had his agent arrange a meeting with Brooker. It so happened Brooker had this standalone episode coming up where Hamm might fit. The script had already been written. An early draft had the part of Matt as a bit grating. Hamm's only requested change, aside from dropping the Cockney accent, was to make Matt likable. He thought making Matt affable and friendly would be a great contrast to his many horrific actions. The guy is a disgusting pig with absolutely no empathy, but you manage to kind of like him in spite of it all. So if you're ready, Refiners, it's time to open the file called White Christmas. As for this title, White Christmas, yeah, it's been used before. The 1942 song from Irving Berlin is what started it all. He originally wrote it for a Bing Crosby movie called Holiday Inn. Then there was a movie called White Christmas to cash in on the popularity of the song. Bing Crosby's 1942 version holds the record as the most purchased single in history, with physical media sales of more than 50 million units.
I'm dreaming of a white Christmas, just like the ones I used to know.
That number jumps to 100 million if you add in albums where the song was included. The Bing Crosby version of the song would return to the charts annually. In order to keep it from disrupting the pop music charts each winter, Billboard created the holiday singles chart as a way to deal with White Christmas. It's a song that evokes warm memories of a snowy, traditional country Christmas in the United States. Leave it to Brooker to name this twisted tale after such a beloved tune. Yes, the events of the show happen on Christmas Day, and it is snowing. Beyond the time of year, there is nothing remotely Christmassy about any of these tales. These are stories of death and depravity. I don't see anyone putting Brooker's White Christmas alongside Elf or It's a Wonderful Life as a favorite holiday movie. The title is just another of Charlie's dark jokes. After seeing the very distinctive Black Mirror opening animation, we cut to a wintry wasteland of high winds and blowing snow. The camera is pulling back to reveal we are viewing this desolate scene through a very deep window. We pull back even further until we are inside a nondescript room. It's some kind of a bunk room. A man sits up in bed. Strains of the song "I Wish It Was Christmas Every Day" by Wizard can be heard. The man rubs his face. It looks like he's waking slowly, but I need to point something out here. When we cut to this guy, he was laying in his bunk awake. He is fully clothed, including his boots, when he gets out of the bunk. I don't believe he was sleeping. Later, we're going to discover something about this man's nature which would indicate he does not sleep. There's a chair in the corner of the room and a couple of bunks visible frame right. My first time here, I thought we were inside some kind of Antarctic research outpost. The few minutes we've been in this place have strongly conveyed desolate, isolated, and very, very cold. The light goes on over the mirror in the bathroom. The man in the mirror is Joe Potter. He is being played by British actor Rafe Spall. Rafe was born in March of 1983 in the Camberwell region of South London. Rafe took up the family business. His father is famed British character actor Timothy Spall. Rafe's acting career began with a small movie role in 2001 when he was 18 years old. He's racked up 70 actor credits since that time. Most of his entries are either movies or TV movies. He's also picked up quite a few TV miniseries. Rafe is a favorite of director Edgar Wright and writer-actor Simon Pegg. Rafe's made appearances in all three of their movies, Shaun of the Dead, Hot Fuzz, and The World's End. Interestingly, Wright is also the writer-director of the 2017 movie Baby Driver, which was referenced in the Lexington Letter. Most recently, Rafe is appearing as a regular on another Apple TV Plus series called Trying. It's about a couple trying to get pregnant. He's in 32 episodes and counting as the character Jason. The tinny but upbeat strains of Christmas Every Day continue. The song doesn't do much to help date the scene. It came out in December of 1973, so this could be happening at any point in the last 50 years. I Wish It Could Be Christmas Every Day has been a perennial favorite in the UK. The first year of release, it peaked at number 4 on the UK singles chart. Since then, it's re-entered the charts seasonally a total of 20 times. That includes peaking at number 25 in 2023. It also tends to chart in Ireland whenever it reappears on the British charts. The song's strongest appearances since it was released have all come in the late 20-teens after this Black Mirror episode went into heavy Netflix rotation. I Wish It Could Be Christmas Every Day has never charted in the U.S. Joe is in an unbuttoned flannel shirt worn over a t-shirt with buttons at the collar. Industrial-looking lights in wire cages are positioned over the doors behind Joe, adding to that Arctic outpost feel. Joe walks right over to the radio and clicks it off. At the click, we reverse cut. There's another person in the room.
I was just getting into that.
It's American actor and ridiculously handsome madman John Hamm, who we mentioned during the intro. These two performers, Hamm and Spall, share some interesting details behind the scenes. They were both born on March 10th, for instance. Hamm is 12 years older. They also both have a raging cold during this shoot. We'll see Hamm even wipe his nose later, and they both appear to be gasping for breath at times. If you want more odd coincidences, Hamm also appeared in the 2017 Edgar Wright movie Baby Driver. Here, he's playing the character Matt, who is currently at the stove cooking.
Roast potatoes.
He says they're doing Christmas. Joe seems confused by this.
Christmas.
Christmas Day, December 25th. You've heard of it?
Joe turns away in disgust. Take note of Joe's reaction here. We're going to talk about the big picture a little later in the episode. Matt mentioned since it's Christmas and all, there's no work today.
Bottles on the table.
No work further lends itself to the idea we're at some kind of a research outpost. Actually, though, I'm getting that feeling a little less now that we're out in the common area. This setting seems a bit too casual to be a research facility. I'm basing this observation on other movies I've seen involving Arctic research facilities. Joe pulls a chair up in front of a roaring, wood-burning stove. Matt's a chatterbox. He continues, talking about the decorations. He references not having any last year. These guys have been here a while. There is a bit of tinsel up alongside the stove area. Matt says only essentials are supposed to be stored here, wherever here might be.
I think it's kind of adorable someone thinks tinsel is essential.
Sitting in the sill of the very deep kitchen window are a couple of holiday figurines. A Santa, a snow-covered tree, and a snowman with an oversized head are all sitting nestled in tinsel. The sink, cabinets, and stove all have that stainless steel industrial feel. There's a shelf of round tins, possibly long-lasting food rations, sitting to the right of the sink. This does make me kind of wonder how Matt has real potatoes after 5 years out here in the tundra. Matt continues to push this idea of holiday hospitality. He says it's good for them to have a meal, a drink.
Oh, good for you or me?
Joe is not up for niceties. He looks very put out.
Come on, what has it been? 5 years? How many sentences have you said to me? Three?
Don't let that reference slip by. We're still getting our bearings, and we don't know anything about these guys or their situation, but this time mention is some important exposition. Matt throws it out like it's nothing, but these two guys have been here alone in this cabin for a full 5 years now. That's more than 1,800 days, and we're led to believe they've all been a lot like this one. The bottle on the table is full of a dark liquid. It's corked, but I don't think it's wine. Whatever it is, Matt's drinking it from a cordial glass. He has his seat at the table. So maybe the three sentences thing was an exaggeration, but not by much.
But come on, there is a little bit of a conversational drought happening here. My ears need water.
After 5 years? I should hope so. Joe says he's not big on conversation. They go back and forth on the topic. Matt is both persuasive and persistent.
So come on. Chit-chat. Conversate. Something.
He's not going to let this go.
Come on, for me. For Christmas.
Well, what do you want to talk about?
A breakthrough, finally, and we get to witness it. I'm glad we weren't forced to hang around with these guys the previous 5 years. Don't you think there have been a number of mornings in the past 5 years, a lot like this one, with Matt pushing and Joe resisting, where there wasn't a breakthrough? What do these guys do all day in this tiny shack in the Arctic if they don't talk? Matt then asks one of those first day together as roomies kinds of questions.
Why are you here?
They've been here together for 5 full years, and Joe has never once mentioned why he's here? This is a huge breakthrough.
No one ends up here without things going to total shit for them back out there.
Out where? The real world? The world beyond the blizzard? They then have an exchange that could have been written by Rick and Hale.
It's a job, not a jail.
Often one and the same thing.
Seriously, that could have come right out of the pages of The UUR.
Page 197 slaps.
So Joe thinks whatever this is a job. I wonder why he has that impression and what it is he's doing as part of his job here in this place. Matt asks again, what went wrong out there? Joe says nothing went wrong, but the question seems to make him agitated. He tries to change the subject.
What about you?
Matt gives him a hard time about this attempt at conversation.
An icebreaker. You're learning.
Well, what went to shit for you?
Matt asks if Joe's sure he doesn't want that drink. He doesn't sound too excited about discussing why he's there. Joe figures Matt must have talked his way into trouble. Matt hedges.
I talked to people. Made money from it.
So what? A DJ? Joe guesses Matt must have been a Los Angeles drive time DJ who got himself in trouble with his big mouth.
I was not a DJ.
Matt pauses, then adds he was more like a guru.
Oh, don't say you were a spiritual guru.
I was decidedly not a spiritual guru.
Yeah, but he would play a demented spiritual guru in about a year as a recurring character on the streaming hit The Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt. There is a trivia item on IMDb which looks wrong after hearing this conversation. It says Joe's first guess as to Matt's profession is marketing person. The first guess we hear in this exchange is morning DJ. It's subtle, but the trivia item is actually correct. Here, Joe is guessing why Matt wound up in this place. Later, Matt will challenge him to guess his profession, which is different from the hobby that seems to have landed him here. When Joe guesses at his profession about halfway through the show, his first guess will be marketing person. This is a sideways reference to Ham's character from Mad Men, who was an ad exec. After the decidedly not line, we cut to a flashback. We're going to get a couple of these from both Matt and Joe. As we are watching the flashbacks, it's important to keep in mind the source of these stories. Each guy is telling us his recollection of the scenes being described. These two aren't necessarily the most reliable narrators. Some of their story might be skewed by their own personal recollections. We cut into the flashback. The story we're about to hear from Matt was one of those standalone ideas Brooker had presented for season 3. It's also the first of the 3 different stories woven into this Christmas special. At the cut, we see a Lucite square sitting on a modern-looking desktop. There's a glowing keyboard to the right and a monitor mounted on the same kind of slightly futuristic-looking Lucite stand. There's what looks like a contact card being displayed on the small Lucite square. It shows a headshot in a circle. Next to the thumbnail is the name Harry S. Check it out, Refiners. Matt's clients also only go by first name, last initial. There are a couple of subtle but classy control icons in the corners. A hand reaches into the frame and taps Harry's face, causing something called an eye link to initiate. The screen changes to, say, establishing eye link. The graphic shows a computer with a Bluetooth symbol in it interacting with the outline of a person's head. The eyes are solid white and a bit weird looking in this graphic. Digital connecting tones can be heard, then...
Hello, Harry.
The scene cuts to the exterior of an apartment building. This is where client Harry S. lives.
Patch through now. How you doing?
Sorry, I'm not quite dressed yet.
Oh, this is no problem for Matt. He says that's why he's here. We cut into a bedroom where a young man is standing in socked feet, underwear, and a dress shirt.
Show me what you're planning on wearing and we'll take things from there.
Harry is buttoning a wrinkled blue dress shirt with a white collar. He turns to the mirror in his bedroom.
How about this?
Harry is being played by British actor Rasmus Hardiker. Rasmus was born in Sutton Coldfield, West Midlands, England, in 1985. Rasmus's career got underway in 2005 with a British TV miniseries. He landed several TV series and movie roles through the end of the decade. Then in the early 20-teens, Rasmus discovered voiceover work. His first voice work was in a couple of 2011 video games. From there, his voiceover career exploded. Since 2011, Rasmus has done voice work for hundreds of episodes of animated television. His performer bio lists 103 acting credits, but an on-screen appearance is kind of rare at this point in his career. Most of his roles since 2011 are voice only and include dozens of episodes. 94 episodes of a show called The Flugels, 47 episodes of Danger Mouse, where one of his voices included Count Duckula, and most recently, 34 episodes of the TV series Hilda, running through the 2023 season. Harry could not look any dorkier. He's a skinny kid with floppy hair, a jutting Adam's apple, and wide bug eyes. Matt is not a fan of the outfit Harry has selected.
Doesn't work. It's boring blue, and you're not boring blue. Not tonight.
If you haven't already guessed, Matt's side hustle is as a dating coach. He's a guru, all right, but not a very spiritual one. These sleazy guys who think they can fool women into dating their clients pop onto the scene every once in a while. They rile feminists, pick up a few more hapless clients, and fade back into the shadows. Sometimes they write controversial and icky books. Usually they work one-on-one with their clients. Will Smith played the title role of a dating guru in his 2005 movie Hitch. There have been episodes of Law & Order SVU dedicated to these slime balls. Howard from Big Bang Theory has on occasion mentioned some of the weird love guru theories he uses in his quest for female companionship. Remember when he wore an eye patch to a bar? It was a dating coach suggestion to get attention. He said they call it peacocking. Harry walks over to his bed where a couple of other shirt-tie combos are laid out. We cut to a point-of-view shot as he looks at them.
All right, which one of these is good?
The shot cuts to an over-the-shoulder view of Matt's monitor. The display shows the words, iLink with Harry S. in the upper left corner of the screen. A running time for the call is in the upper right. On the screen, we're able to see the two shirt-tie combos laying on Harry's bed. This dating sequence is the first of three different stories intertwined in this episode. Although a couple of them were shot down by Channel 4 as not being Black Mirror enough, each of these stories could have been their own standalone episode. The tech we're seeing in use here is called Zed Eyes, or Z Eyes, for the U.S. market. This is the same technology as the grains used in the Season 1 Black Mirror episode called The Entire History of You. This was a departure for the show. They normally wouldn't repeat tech from episode to episode, but the grains were just too perfect when it came to date coaching. The writers have described Zed Eyes as a cross between permanent contacts and Google Glass. Matt will mention later how they can't be removed. By linking to the output of Harry's Z Eyes, Matt is able to see everything Harry is seeing. Now, consider this technology as applied to a dating coach. In a situation like Hitch, the coach isn't on the date. They have to wait until after their client gets home for a report. Not with Zed Eyes. Now your dating coach can be right there with you, in your ear, and looking at the world through your very own eyes. You, of course, would never tell the girl you're chatting up that you've got at least one other person involved in your date. In Matt's case, several guys show up virtually to watch the proceedings and offer advice as Harry S. goes out on the town. If this sounds sleazy and very unfair to the mark being hit on, you would be right. This type of group help during a date actually seems to be illegal in this future world. Remember when Google Glass was introduced and the units were immediately banned in strip clubs? New tech always comes with a sticky coating of legal issues because people will always try to exploit it.
White shirt with a black tie, with a slim-cut gray jacket. Classic, timeless, smart.
Matt is both confident and opinionated. He tells Harry to sort out that hair. Harry runs his hands through it, providing a bit of control. Harry is obviously very nervous.
Remember those breathing techniques we talked about, okay?
Matt says Harry's going to be fine. Harry repeats this like a mantra, but his voice is shaky.
It's going to be fine.
Cut to a door opening into a noisy bar. Harry is entering, wearing his white shirt, black tie, and jacket. Harry scans the ladies just inside the door as he enters.
She's cute.
Yes.
It's great having your wingman in your head, but Harry has to remember he can be heard. The lady he's checking out gives him a disparaging glance after he blurts his odd yes. The time on Matt's screen shows we've been with Harry for nearly 52 minutes now.
Not out loud.
Yeah, in addition to being the geekiest guy in the room, Harry doesn't want to also be the guy who's talking to himself. Matt tells him to carefully pick his spots when he wants to talk out loud. Harry looks out of place in this group. He starts to make his way through the crowd. Matt has a graphic of the restaurant floor plan pulled up on the iConnect screen. He can see there's a private party happening in the back room.
If you walk in there like you belong, no one's going to say anything.
It's the Megson Company Christmas party, staying with our Christmas special theme. We cut back into the cabin.
So what were you running? Some corporate espionage outfit?
Romantic services.
He calls it an in-the-field way to provide assistance.
You coach dorks whilst they crew singles bars?
Yeah, pretty much, but Matt says singles bars are depressing. He tells his clients to avoid them. Instead, Matt's protégés do their trolling in regular bars and nightclubs.
But at Christmas time, the gate crash office parties.
Matt explains his reasoning.
All the attractive women have been surrounded by regulation office ass clowns for the whole year, and now they want to let their hair down.
Hey, did you hear it, Refiner? We've got an origins callback to Office Space, where the term ass clown was first made famous. This is a few years before it would wind up in Webster's dictionary, but I'm glad to hear Matt using it. One of the criteria for adopting a new word is if it's in regular use in society. Joe's not believing Matt and his theories about pretty women at Christmas parties.
According to the pop psychologist.
Matt shrugs. He says he knows how the mind works. Yeah, but he also looks like John Hamm. There's a big difference between the geeky Harry S. and a guy who looks like John Hamm. If I might interject my own bit of pop psychology here, a guy who looks like Matt is always going to be far more well-received if he just happens to show up out of the blue at your office Christmas party. Guys like Harry, not so much. We cut to the flashback. Matt is telling Harry to not stand around like a lamppost.
I'll go to the bar.
Matt reminds him to move with purpose, but even with purpose, Harry looks like a scared kid. As he approaches the bar, he's starting to ask for a drink. Another guy, larger and louder, pushes past Harry, shouting his own order. Matt chuckles and tells Harry not to worry about this aggressive dork. Harry doesn't even need a real beer.
Just grab one of those empty bottles off the bar while Captain Douchebag orders his piss water. We're just going to need it for a prop anyway.
We watch through Harry's eyes as he grabs one of the empty bottles. Matt tells Harry to look around. Does he see anything he likes? Harry's gaze stops on a blonde and a brunette who are talking to a guy in a white shirt. Harry, remembering to not speak out loud in the crowded bar, taps on the neck of the beer bottle to indicate where he's looking. Matt, of course, figures Harry has designs on the Western standard of attractive, the blonde in the white dress. When he says something about her, Harry taps again on the bottleneck.
The dark-haired girl.
The blonde's friend not only has dark hair, but she's also dressed in a rather dark outfit.
Interesting choice. Go straight over, but focus on the blonde.
At the time this episode was in production, a real-life version of Matt, probably a much more toxic one, was in the news. A guy named Julian Blanc described himself as an international leader in dating advice in a 2014 Time magazine article. In November of 2014, during the production of this episode, Blanc was seeking a work visa for the UK. He was denied admission because it was publicly promoted dating strategies. His approach to dating was determined by government officials to be sexual harassment and sexual assault. His techniques to deceive and manipulate women into sex involved both force and emotional abuse. Blanc, of course, denied the accusations, but Britain stayed strong. He was not allowed entry into the country. Harry is hesitant to walk over to the two women.
Now, come on. Confidence. You can do this.
Building self-confidence was also a huge part of Julian Blanc's teachings. Harry gets himself fired up and heads over to the ladies. As he's moving, Matt is typing.
Hold on, just finding out who they are.
He freezes the image on the monitor showing Harry's POV. Matt then taps the faces of the two ladies, and an image search window pops up. The internet starts to deliver pics of these two from their social media posts. In reality, the blonde girl, Amy, is being played by UK actress Verity Marshall. Verity was born in the Hammersmith neighborhood of London in 1986. She has 23 credits on her IMDb profile beginning in 2008 and running through an episode of a series called Midsummer Murders in 2023. Verity's roles are almost entirely on TV, either in series or TV movies. Amy's friend, the dark-haired Jennifer, is being played by Natalia Tena, an English actress and musician born November 1st of 1984. Her performer resume includes more than 50 credits dating back to 2002, with two appearances upcoming. She was the recurring character Nymphadora Tonks in three of the Harry Potter movies. She also appeared as the character Osha in 16 episodes of Game of Thrones. Natalia's music career might even be more interesting than her acting roles. Natalia is the lead singer and accordionist for the band Molotov Jukebox. I figured this group was worth checking out based on the name alone. They are all over Apple Music with multiple album and EP releases. This cut is one of their most popular. It's a song called Don't Panic.
Don't panic. Breathing slow.
It's interesting stuff, and not the kind of thing I'd expect to hear from an outfit called Molotov Jukebox.
Okay, bullshit opener.
Try the horse story at the blonde girl.
According to Brooker, this horse story is an actual tip from a dating guru. He picked it up at some point during the Julian Blanc reporting and decided he had to use it somewhere in the show.
Hey, so did anyone see that guy outside riding the horse?
He specifically directs this question to the blonde. Did she see him?
Put a guy on a horse.
Harry says it was about 20 minutes ago. He was shirtless and riding a horse down the high street. The blonde is engaging with him. The dark-haired girl looks away. Harry's voice is all false bravado. He looks scared, but he seems emboldened by the reaction to his story. He then adds in the detail of a bow and arrow.
He probably did it for a bet, but he looked like something out of Tolkien, you know?
This is a Lord of the Rings reference, just in case you've never heard of J.R.R. Tolkien. If you haven't heard of Tolkien, you really should look him up. The balding guy in the white shirt who had been talking to the ladies isn't thrilled about Harry's interruption. He, of course, has to alpha up in front of the women.
Sorry. Who are you?
Matt tells Harry to stall until he can find something. We can take a moment to do the same thing. This partygoer, who we will discover is named Dawson, is being played by British actor Ian Attard. Ian's had a relaxed career with 16 TV series and TV movie appearances stretched out over 16 years. Refiners, I do want you to take note of an interesting detail about Ian. His real middle name, which he sometimes uses as an actor, is Keir. His is spelled K-E-I-R, but that's close enough to give me a bit of a chill. This guy is pretty aggressive when it comes to proving Harry's a gatecrasher.
You're not from the office.
Who do you know from here?
Matt is still searching for his name.
Say, I know you. Friendly.
Pictures are populating in the search window for Mr. Alpha, but no name yet.
I know you for one.
Scared as he is, Harry is pretty good at covering with the BS. Finally, the name pops on Matt's search screen.
Dawson.
Dawson, isn't it?
Like any citizen of a certain age in a developed country in the 21st century, Dawson may have overshared just a bit on his social media accounts.
You met at Kath's Barbecue.
Which is memorialized in photos there on one of Dawson's accounts. Matt says Dawson will pretend to remember even if he doesn't, which he does. The dark-haired girl seems to take a side glance notice of Harry. Matt tells him to not neglect the blonde.
You, I don't know.
Amy,
hi.
This is another one of those sleazy pickup guy tricks. It's called negging. By ignoring and, in effect, negating the presence of the dark-haired girl, Harry's making her want to be noticed. At least, that's the theory. It's a jealousy reflex. Why does this guy I don't know seem to be ignoring me in favor of talking with my friend? Should I be a bit more outgoing and talkative to get his attention? If you believe the love gurus, yes, the negged girl will go out of her way to get some attention. Matt tells Harry to get the blonde to introduce him to the dark-haired girl.
So, all of your friends this suspicious?
Nice.
Amy then introduces Harry to the dark-haired and big-eyed Jennifer.
Hi, Jennifer.
Hi.
Matt then has Harry turn his attention back to the blonde. He says they can do some of the funny material they've been working on. As Harry launches into more girl-attracting shtick, we cut back to the cabin.
The tactic, generally, was to deliberately freeze out the one you're actually interested in.
It makes the guy seem less needy, but he said it would also make the girl sort of lean into the conversation.
People want to be noticed.
Ah, but not the dark-haired girl. She seems just fine with being ignored. We cut back to the party as Matt continues in voiceover. Joe has a theory.
Maybe she could smell a loser.
Matt says, no, that's not it. This girl was different.
She was an outsider. An attractive outsider. And there's nothing more tantalizing than that.
Back at the party, the dark-haired girl has wandered off. Harry's funny material must be working because Amy is still there and really engaging with him. She's well into an animated but mundane story. Harry should have pursued Amy, but no, he's got to have big-eyed and mysterious. Matt says the dark-haired girl will be a challenge, but don't quit.
Let's let our friend Amy here.
He had her on for a little while and then find an excuse to slip away.
On the balcony till
at
like
the first break in the story, Harry jumps in to say he has to go to the little boys' room.
So just keep the party going and, you know.
Sure.
Harry excuses himself, leaving Amy suddenly standing all alone. Harry is off in pursuit of Jennifer, but he does actually have to go. Back on Matt's iLink feed, we can see a bathroom sink. Then the camera view swings over to a urinal. Harry sets his beer bottle on the edge of the sink and heads for the urinal. We look at the urinal for a bit, but there's a pause.
Do you actually have to go?
We continue looking at the bottom of the urinal.
Yeah, but it's
not easy with you watching.
Matt promises he won't peek, and Harry is able to get a stream going. There's a bit of a gross cut from the urinal to the pot of potatoes now boiling on the stove.
So you streamed everything he saw? And he trusted you with that?
Matt says he was the only one watching, but we immediately discover that's not true. We cut back to Matt's workstation where the display continues to show the stream in the urinal. On a monitor to the right of the Z-Eyes display is what looks like a Zoom room with eight windows open.
Jesus, how much urine? He's pissing like a harpoon cow.
It's making me want to go. Well, it is.
These are the guys from Matt's club, as Harry is going to refer to it in a bit. They are also in on this little outing. Harry is aware. We'll find out he's been a part of some of the dates of other guys we see in this window. These guys will be weighing in on the rest of the evening. From here on, we as viewers are seeing more of what actually happened on the date, while Joe is getting a somewhat sanitized version of the story from Matt. Check the visible usernames under the windows. We've got a couple of Easter eggs here. Pie Ape was an insult hurled in the second episode of the series. It was an installment called 15 Million Credits. Next to him is Nixon. There's a name I can't see. Then the last username on the top row is I Am Waldo in all caps with underscores between the words. This is a reference to the previous episode, the third and final episode of season 2, called The Waldo Moment. On the bottom row of the screen, we find usernames Popcorn with a K, El Nino, Fappuccino, and Wigwam. No Easter eggs on the bottom row as far as I could tell. Back at the party, Harry is out of the bathroom and on the prowl. He spots the dark-haired Jennifer seated across the room.
Harry, your best bet is to just go over and start talking to her.
Well, sure, but that's a lot easier said than done. Matt tells him to establish a rapport. Don't be afraid of her. Matt turns to the Greek chorus of pervs on the other screen.
Okay, guys, any observations so far helping our man out here?
The guy in the bottom row who goes by El Nino says she's pretty, but why isn't anyone else hitting on her? Harry seems to have her all to himself. Another of the gang on the screen says she might be closed off to the point the other men in the room have just given up. One of the guys identifies her as an outsider with nothing in common with these people.
Okay, that's a possible in.
Matt tells Harry to start a conversation with her, but be cynical.
Right? Cutting.
Why do people torture themselves with these stupid parties anyway?
Like Bonnie and Clyde, huh? You two against the world.
This is kind of a downer of a reference. Bonnie Parker and Clyde Barrow were American bandits who robbed banks and killed people in the southern U.S. from 1931 through 34. They died together in a shootout in Bienville Parish, Louisiana, in May of 1934. The pair were 23 years old at the time they were killed. During their three-year crime spree, they killed 9 police officers and 4 civilians. Although violent and crazy, Bonnie and Clyde are known for having a deep and passionate love for one another. Harry has his seat on the same couch as Jennifer. The decoration in this bar is unique. There's what looks like a fireplace mantle with a miniature Christmas tree sitting on it next to Jennifer. Next to Harry, it looks like somebody left their lightsaber in an alcove. A length of tinsel is hung between them, outlining what is identified as the stage door.
Confidence. Confidence. Just talk to her.
Harry launches into some decent small talk. He says these parties are nothing but enforced fun.
Maybe everyone else enjoys it. Maybe it's just me.
Jennifer assures him it is definitely not just him. Matt is happy with this response. He says to continue with the outsider small talk.
And keep looking at her. I need to gauge her reactions.
Harry then launches into some cringy small talk. He makes air quotes and uses the term kindred spirit, which he immediately reels back in. Despite the awkwardness, Jennifer's going for it. She responds by using air quotes, which is both funny and approving. They start to compare notes about why these parties are so bad. She says the noise wrecks it for her.
All the talking and talking, it never fucking stops.
Matt picks up on this.
Okay, she curses, so should you.
This is another one of those douchey tricks used by pickup artists. It's called mirroring, and it's just like it sounds. If they do it, you do it, but subtly. Harry is not so good with the subtle part of it.
Shit, fucking. I fucking always totally think that it's fucking shit, you know?
I can't think through all the bubble.
Swearing never sounds right coming from someone who doesn't do it regularly. They're too self-conscious about what they're saying. Plus, Harry's just not making any sense. Jennifer doesn't seem to care. She says the only way she got through it last year was because she was on drugs. Harry laughs at this at first, but then does a double take when he realizes what she's just said.
It must have been pretty strong because I actually enjoyed myself.
We get a funny exchange here with Matt.
That's cool.
Don't say cool.
I wish I had some drugs right now.
No, you don't.
Jennifer doesn't want any either. She says she doesn't take them anymore. This year, she's even gone very anti-drug.
Well, that's good because you don't
need that shit in your system.
The Greek chorus of bros chimes in. They're trying to identify her personality. Matt tells Harry this setting is too public. They need to find somewhere else to talk. Matt is trying to find Jennifer's social profile, but it's locked, private. If he'd have been given the chance to see some of her posts, he might have been able to give Harry a heads up. We cut to potatoes being dumped from a strainer onto a cookie sheet. We're back in the cabin, and Matt is still working on those roast potatoes for Christmas. Matt tells Joe seduction is about listening. It's about giving your attention to the other person.
Full attention. Like you're not giving me now. What's wrong?
Joe looks distracted. He points to the wall across the room.
A clock.
What about it?
He says he never noticed it before. I went back to have a look, and they don't let us really see this wall in earlier scenes. I don't know if it was there or not, but for some reason, Joe's never noticed it.
5 years? Jesus.
Matt continues to talk about the strategy of his pickup methods as Joe puts a hand at the base of his throat and stares at the newly noticed clock. You can tell there's something both familiar and frightening for him about that clock. We cut back to Harry and Jennifer at the bar or restaurant or whatever it is. They've adjourned to a back storage room where it's quieter and more private. In the establishing shot, we can see chairs stacked along the walls and what might be high chairs stacked in the foreground to the left of the frame. Harry is continuing to schmooze Jennifer by complimenting her.
So, well, I would guess that either every guy in there has already tried to hit on you or maybe they find you too intimidating.
This kind of concerns Jennifer. She asks if she is intimidating. Harry starts to backpedal.
No. I'm just, No, I just imagine that they all kind of want to get inside your
head.
Jennifer's getting very relaxed. She says some of them have tried, not directly, which is an interesting comment. How are they getting into her head indirectly? She says some of them send messages. She doesn't say exactly how they send these messages. I'm betting Harry's thinking text or email. Jennifer might be more in the telepathic realm. She then says they make it known what they're thinking. Well, okay, this might be through their actions, but I'm guessing, again, she's getting these messages through a different pipeline.
It's just tiring, you know. It just doesn't end ever.
Harry is smitten. He's got a huge grin on his face, and he is very genuinely interested in what this dark-haired girl with the big eyes has to say, even if he isn't hearing the double meaning. Matt tells Harry to ask how long she's worked here at,
Mags and Frank.
She tells him 3 years.
Oh, wow, so 3 Christmas parties.
She nods, but then says this one will be her last. Interesting. Harry asks, are you leaving? He doesn't say going to another job, but I'm just sure that's what he's implying.
I've been planning it forever, but you know what it's like. You know you have to do it, but when it comes right down to it, it's hard to work up the courage.
She's been planning on leaving, but you mean planning to quit, right? And go to another job? Harry assumes as much, but she doesn't say it specifically. If you listen closely, she is being very vague with her answers. Harry empathizes. He launches into an analogy about jumping into a cold swimming pool. You know it's going to be cold.
But you know, moments after you jump in, that it'll be fine. It's the fear of the shock that holds you back.
Harry is connecting with Jennifer in a way that is very dangerous, but he has no idea. He continues with this very vague analogy. It could be about quitting one job and going to another, or it could be about killing yourself and leaving this plane of existence. It's the shock and fear of change that holds you back. He says you're ultimately worried about the transition from one state to another.
And that can't hurt you because it's just a state change.
Great stuff, kid.
Harry doesn't realize it, but he's being the opposite of the suicide prevention hotline. He's paving the way for Jennifer's thoughts to turn into actions. Harry then starts talking about hearing voices in his head, which is an unfortunate turn of phrase.
Right, and it's frustrating because you've always got these 10 voices in your head saying don't do it, and another 10 in your head saying do it.
Harry has shined a light on this girl's darkest thoughts, and he isn't aware in the least. She wants to know which voices should she listen to.
The do it's.
Oh, Harry, you don't know what you're saying. Jennifer is resolute. She's finally going to do this. Harry raises his beer bottle.
To changing states.
To changing states.
Jennifer also raises her glass, but she hits it too hard against Harry's bottle. Some of her drink sloshes onto his pants. Jennifer quickly puts a hand on his knee to wipe it off. As Harry looks down at his knee, the douche gallery goes out of their minds.
She touched his fucking knee!
Harry, you're doing great. No,
any physical touch is a huge win, but getting a touch below the waist is like opening a door for these sleazeballs. Harry offers to buy her another drink.
Let me think. I just need a little sec.
She stands and walks out of the storeroom as we cut back to the snowbound cabin. Matt is stropping a blade as Joe continues to glower at the table. His glass is empty again. A few drinks may be loosening him up a bit.
So thanks to you, some gorko finally meets a girl. It's not much of a Christmas story.
Ah, but we're not done with the story. Ham does slip in a little holiday double entendre here.
Maybe it comes down her chimney.
Wouldn't want to forget this is, after all, a Christmas special. Back at the club, Harry is having misgivings. Jennifer is still in the loo, so he starts talking directly to Matt and the boys. He doesn't feel comfortable doing the group chat to get the girl. He thinks it's cheating.
I'd never have even had the nerve to talk to her.
Well, of course not, but aren't you glad you did? There's a cutaway to Jennifer now returning from the loo. She enters the room just as Harry launches into a bit of a monologue about how hard it is to do this with all of them in his head.
It's a bit of a head fuck. I just kind of want you to all go away.
Jennifer definitely hears him as he is deep in this animated conversation, but she doesn't say anything. Harry clears his throat and shuts up as he sees her approach.
Come back to mine. Sorry?
Hold on. Come back to what now? Does she mean her place?
I thought about asking you, and a little voice said, do it, so I'm doing it.
Oh, sure. You gotta listen to those do it voices, as Harry says. Wow, she very definitely is inviting him back to her place. This is beyond Harry's wildest dreams, but doesn't it seem maybe a little too easy? Harry doesn't even know how to respond.
Say yes.
He's hemming and hawing.
I want to do this.
Yes, she does, but the this she wants to do is not the this Harry is thinking. Jennifer tells him it's her way of saying thanks. Then she pushes in fast for a kiss. It's a big leap for her, but she goes for it. Harry is shocked. Why isn't he saying yes? The Greek chorus of goons goes nuts.
On his first run! His first
just
bloody
say yes.
Run!
Yes, yes, yes.
Cut to a door opening into a darkened apartment. As promised, Jennifer is taking Harry back to her place.
I don't usually bring people back here.
Harry says he's honored as he passes by her into the apartment. Her front door is bathed in a pink light. We can hear Joe from the cabin break into the story in voiceover.
Did you watch? When they went back to hers and got up to whatever they got up to, did you carry on watching through his eyes?
My reaction to this question the first time I heard it was, well, of course he did. And so did the rest of the crew. These guys are sleazeballs. This is why they're here. If one of them gets lucky on a date, the rest of them get to experience it vicariously firsthand, thanks to Z-Eyes. Quick aside here, what's the difference between Z-Eyes and Z-Eyes? Well, none. They're referring to the same thing. Z is used as the name of the last letter in the alphabet in every English-speaking country in the world, except the United States. Zed is a derivation from the original Greek zeta, Z-E-T-A. The French changed the spelling to Z-E-D-E for their word. The Brits, who borrowed a lot from the French, shortened it to just Zed. So why did we Americans insist on Z? Well, you can blame word wrangler Noah Webster for that one. Shortly after the end of the Revolutionary War, Webster began to publish his Dictionary of American English. The newly formed country planned to keep speaking English, but Webster wanted it to be a different English from that of the mother country they'd recently defeated. Webster shortened words with O-U-R in them, like color, behavior, and honor, to just O-R. He also changed Z to Z as the name for the last letter of the alphabet. Webster's changes were being adopted, but slowly. Then, in 1835, the alphabet song using the word Z was copyrighted by a Boston music publisher. That settled it. A catchy rhyme in a popular song meant U.S. school children would forever be saying Z instead of Z. Actually, even though no one else in the world changed over, the U.S. still kind of won this battle. These days, British elementary teachers report having to correct kindergartners and first graders with Z instead of Z. They had already learned the American word as preschoolers from U.S. TV shows like Sesame Street. So back to Joe's question as to whether Matt kept watching. Matt's a bit indignant to have even been asked.
What do you think I am?
Joe says he clearly doesn't know, but I think I do. I've been around Matt long enough to know the answer to this question. Of course he kept watching. Matt lies and says no, his job was done. He claims he shut everything off. We know better, but Joe buys the idea that Matt did the right thing.
Of course I didn't watch.
Back at Jennifer's apartment, Harry is checking out the decorations. We are, too, thanks to his Z-eyes. Everything feels a little bit off about her apartment, but this does not deter the Perv brothers.
Kooky decor.
Indicating sexual adventurousness.
Harry has made his way into Jennifer's living room. She's standing in the doorway.
I'll get the drinks.
Harry starts to have a seat on the couch, but Jennifer stops him.
Yeah, okay, I'll just sit.
The bedroom's that big. Yeah, okay.
Come on, Harry, do you really think everything is going to fall into place this easily? This is a dream scenario.
I'll meet you in there.
Ah, but she is a pretty one. It's hard to see past the big eyes and stocking-clad legs. Otherwise, Harry might have had more of a heads up regarding what's about to happen. In the bedroom, she's even got a neon sign on the wall that's three X's, as in triple X. Who is this girl? Matt tells Harry he's going to the moon just sooner than expected. Harry is a bit freaked about how fast things are moving.
I can't do it.
This is first-time nerves.
It's happening so suddenly. I didn't expect this quickly.
You just gotta roll with it.
Harry then voices his true concern.
I don't want you all to see.
Oh, no, he's Mr. Fucking Ethics.
Well, now wait. You were happy to take a window seat while others did it.
That was completely different.
Didn't you have any objections when you watched me getting sacked off by that German girl? That was a first date.
Look.
Refund.
Truth comes out. He can't shut them off now that things are heating up. This is the bonus for being a part of the group. You get to watch the other guys on their dates. Harry has been a watcher, but now he's reluctant to be watched. As for the guys playing the guys in the group on the screen, they're all listed on IMDb if you're interested. These are all British or Irish actors whose careers really started in the early 20-teens. None has done anything huge, but they've all worked pretty consistently the past decade or so. Harry says it's all too real. She's too real, and he likes her.
Nothing is too real.
The conversation ends abruptly as Jennifer comes into the bedroom. She's carrying a couple of low juice glasses with a pulpy-looking white liquid in them. It might be lemonade, but there's no ice and they're low glasses. Jennifer wonders why Harry isn't on the bed.
I just didn't want to be too presumptuous.
She crosses the room looking serious.
I need you on the bed.
And none of this is raising any red flags with anyone. One of the guys on the monitor breathes a low.
Jesus.
They still think they're watching the best first date ever. Harry sits on the bed and Jennifer straddles him. She puts her mouth close to his ear.
I can't fucking wait.
She then pushes one of the glasses to Harry's mouth so he can take a drink. The sleaze team is wanting her top off and right now.
Is she gonna take that top off?
If it's not tits, I want a discount.
They're gonna have sex. You're getting the season finale in episode one.
Yeah, but if I don't see her tits...
Look, will you please be patient? Jesus.
Back in the bedroom, Harry takes a small sip from the glass Jennifer is holding. He coughs hard. Whatever she has seems to be a bit caustic. Matt asks if he's okay in there. Harry asks what that is he just sipped.
Fuck them is what it is. A big glass of fuck them.
Okay, that's not good. Jennifer starts into a rant about them. The perv crew also realizes this is not good. Finally.
I'm not getting tits, am I?
They are a bit selfish. Matt is looking into his monitor with concern.
I stopped taking the pills they said I should take because they dull the sound.
Uh-oh. The crazy girl is off her meds and the voices are getting louder.
Always they've spoken to me. Always there, and I've had it.
The crazy is now practically dripping from Jennifer. Matt says Harry should be wrapping this up. Big kudos to Natalia Tena as Jennifer. She has been doing a fantastic job teasing Harry as the mysterious dark-haired ingenue. Now she's making this very subtle but terrifying transition to the schizophrenic and suicidal goth girl. Her portrayal is both heartbreaking and disaffected. She's really doing an outstanding job with this part. Her blasé approach to murdering someone is chilling. Back in the bedroom, Jennifer says she was planning on drinking this tonight to make the voices stop.
And then I met you. It was fate.
Good old Harry with his talk of state changes and shocks to the system. And of course, do it.
You knew what it was like, and you said do it.
Fate had dropped this perfect suicide buddy right in her lap. Harry can't stop coughing.
What's in the drink?
It doesn't matter.
Harry was also talking to the voices. She heard him.
I know you hear them too. I saw you talking to them.
Harry says no, he was talking to real people. These aren't just voices in his head, they're real.
Harry, get out of there now.
He's frantically trying to explain. It's like a club. They meet girls, they talk to each other. Jennifer isn't hearing any of it.
No one understands me either.
That one tiny sip has had a huge effect on Harry. He's still coughing and seems barely able to take a breath. His mouth is bloody. He's almost babbling, talking about the leader, this one guy who is the leader of their group. Harry's explanation is only reinforcing Jennifer's assumptions.
We're the same.
No, they're not. But Harry has made it appear he's on the same crazy wavelength, and that's more than enough for Jennifer. She was afraid to do this alone, but now that she's got a suicide buddy, it'll be a lot easier.
They can see you, they can see me.
No one understands what that's like.
For old Harry here, Jennifer is ranting about people shouting at her from government depots as Harry is choking and gasping on the bed.
Not anymore.
There's blood on Harry's chin and teeth. Jennifer downs her glass of fuck them. She says it's time for Harry to have his, but he doesn't want it.
State change.
Sure, nothing to be afraid of, just a state change, like Harry said back at the club.
And soon, they won't be there, and we'll be free.
Harry looks bad. He's stopped fighting, and there's blood all around his mouth. Jennifer has anticipated Harry's reluctance. She produces a large plastic funnel, which she jams into Harry's mouth. Jennifer then starts to pour from the still full glass. We get a terrifying shot from Harry's POV, looking up through the semi-opaque funnel. We can see Jennifer's earnest face looking down at him as she begins to pour. We cut back to the cabin outpost.
She murdered him.
Mercy killing, she'd say.
Joe asks when Matt found out about this because, you know, Joe thinks Matt stopped watching.
It's out on a newscast, I think.
To be such a good liar, this is a lousy lie. We cut back to Matt still at his computer screen. He's looking on in horror as we hear Harry screaming and gurgling. A quick cut back to the screen shows Jennifer finishing off her drink. Matt tells the group to wipe and destroy everything. They can't have any record of their involvement in this. Matt shuts down his screens and starts to gather up what are probably storage devices, like thumb drives. He puts them all in a small trash can, which he douses with lighter fluid. He turns off the lights and heads into the hall. Matt makes his way down a flight of stairs. We pass by what is obviously a nursery. Matt's breathing is labored as we follow him. You can tell this experience has left him pretty freaked out. At the bottom of the stairs, he steps on what is either a dog's or a child's squeaky toy. Ooh, that was pretty loud. Matt pauses, making sure no one in the house is stirring. He slowly pulls his foot off the toy. It breathes another tiny sigh. A few steps later, he trips on something else. Whatever this is, it's really noisy. The kids' toys were left out. A light comes on and a blonde woman in pajamas appears in the hall.
What's going on?
She asks Matt what he's doing. He's speechless and has obviously been caught doing something he shouldn't. Cut back to the cabin, we're looking at a low-angle shot of the stovetop and sink. Matt is starting to transfer food to plates.
So, Claire, she was my wife. She's British. I like her.
And I'm your wife, in fact.
Claire found out I was involved and took what you might call a dim view.
Matt then says...
She blocked me.
Blocking becomes an important part of two of our stories. We all know about social media blocks. The idea of being able to block somebody from having any contact with you is pretty common on social media platforms. In Charlie Brooker's Future of Zed Eyes, with a constantly implanted social media connection, blocking gets even more sinister and complete. Blocking someone with ZIs means they can't see you or hear you in the real world. To the blocked person, you look like an outline filled with static. Anything you say is garbled and muted. The blocked person looks the same to the blocker. Blocking extends to any image of the person doing the blocking. Any photo or video you have online is protected when you block someone. The blocked person will only see your staticky outline, even in an old pic. They can't stalk you or troll your profile to see what you're up to, because any new post will be nothing but static. Additionally, as we'll find out during Charlie's story, this blocking can extend to the offspring of the person who puts the block in place. These blocks are very complete.
You ever been blocked?
There's a cut to the flashback. Matt's wife is pointing a controller in his direction. She's using her thumb to select from a menu floating in space. She makes her selection and Matt becomes a static-filled profile. He tells us about the frustration of being blocked.
Once they hit that button, that's it. You're locked out. End of conversation. You can't hear or speak to them. They can't hear or speak to you. Every time you look at them, there's just this... anonymous shape.
He says it usually only lasts an hour or so, but sometimes they let it go longer.
Price of progress, I suppose.
The progress is Zed Eyes. Matt doesn't say why, but he says they all got them put in. I'm very curious as to what prompted this wide adoption of Zed Eyes. Was it a voluntary thing, a societal thing, or maybe a government thing? Is there somebody making people get ZEyes, or are they like a smartphone? Everybody just had to have them because they were the new cool thing.
Which is all fine and dandy until something like this happens, and then it's bullshit. You can't even take them out.
This is a bit of exposition to help everybody understand Joe's story, which is coming up in a little bit. Matt has put a couple of basic-looking plates of food on the table. As he's talking, he stirs something in a Santa's head pitcher.
Packet gravy. How British.
Packet gravy is a British term. It's just any gravy you mix up out of an envelope. McCormick makes several types of packet gravy. Matt pours a liberal amount over his potatoes.
Merry Christmas.
He downs a slug from the cordial glass, then reaches to pour more of whatever is in that dark bottle. He offers it silently to Joe. Joe, arms folded, gives a bit of a nod, and Matt pours.
Now we're festive. Huh?
Joe still looks closed off, but he is letting Matt get into his head just a bit. Matt hoists his now filled cordial glass.
To Christmas.
The two men clink glasses. Joe slugs down the whole thing. Matt offers up an epilogue to his story of Harry and the deadly date, and you can really hear him battling his cold in this line.
Anyway, she left me, took custody of Mel. It's our daughter. Hence, stranding me in this lovely place.
He says he didn't want to be surrounded by reminders, but 5 years here seems a bit extreme. He does say she stranded him here, as though he's not in this place voluntarily. We still don't know exactly why these men are here or what they're supposed to be doing. As soon as Matt says he didn't want to be surrounded by reminders, we hear a very clear sound. It's the sound of a large cell door closing, like in a jail or a prison. Joe definitely heard this sound. He whirls around, reacting to it. This is our first indication that where we are may not be reality. And with that, refiners, the old analog clock on the wall is saying we need to take a break. This is the end of the first tale contained in this Twisted Holiday special. When we resume next time, we'll pick up with the story of Matt's real job. For now, refiners, it's almost time for you to hit the elevator. Before you go, refiner, a reminder about this Severed Patreon page. Help me out, support the podcast, and join the fun as a patron refiner. We've got severance talk, behind-the-scenes info, and other goodies you won't get from the regular podcast. Become a patron refiner by going to patreon.com/severedpod. That's patreon.com/severedpod. I need to supplement my retirement income with this podcasting thing, or I might have to go out and find a real job. I'd rather keep podcasting. Sign up now for only $5 a month. A little bit from a lot of people is what makes it work. Season 2 of Severance keeps getting closer and closer. As of this recording, we've started to see wrap-up notices from some of the primary players. Both Britt Lauer and Jen Tulloch have posted their wrap-up photos. With primary shooting complete, now post-production begins in earnest. I've been hoping some CGI work has already been done on existing footage, but the real work of post-production couldn't get going until the field shooting was complete. I'm betting the production team is now gearing up to spend the summer in an editing booth. I'm still optimistic about a late fall release date. My birthday is November 19th. I'm counting on the launch of Season 2 as my birthday present. Between now and then, make sure to keep tabs on the Severed Facebook page. I'll be reporting all the S2 details as soon as I know anything. Close down your workstations, refiners. It's time to get back to your Audi lives. Exit via the elevator, and remember, as always, please stagger your exits.
You've been listening to Severed, the ultimate severance podcast. Severed is written, produced, and hosted by Alan Stair.
Severed is not endorsed by Red Hour Productions, Endeavor Content, or Apple TV+. This podcast is intended for entertainment and informational purposes only.
Severance, the Severance logo, and all video and audio of Severance and Severance characters are registered trademarks of Red Hour, Endeavor Content, Apple TV+, or their respective copyright holders.
Please make sure to leave a 5-star rating and review for Severed at Apple Podcasts.